Welcome back to the Deep Dive. All right, today we're going deep on these Think and Act Locally ebooks.
From tomsfreebooks.com, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it seems like they're all interviews with people who, well, how did Tom Woods put it?
People who challenge the idea that the American establishment always has our best interests at heart.
Right, yeah. And Tom Woods himself is, well, he's kind of a big deal himself, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, for sure. He's got like, what, 13 books? Including a couple New York Times bestsellers. Yeah. And he won that Hayek Lifetime Achievement Award a while back.
Yeah, so these interviews, they're probably not for the faint of heart. So first up, we have Michael Rechtenwald, a former NYU professor.
Yeah, he got into some hot water for his critiques of safe spaces and trigger warnings.
Ooh, that's got to be a touchy subject, especially at a university.
Definitely. Especially since he actually started out as a Marxist.
Really?
Yeah, but he became disillusioned with how he felt the left was handling free speech and academic discourse.
So he was like, hey, wait a minute.
Pretty much. And he didn't hold back either, criticizing safe spaces and trigger warnings very publicly. He even did an interview with the student newspaper and wasn't shy on Twitter either.
So he basically threw a grenade into the system.
Yeah, you could say that. And NYU's diversity, equity, and inclusion group was not happy.
Oh, I bet they weren't.
Nope, they put him on paid leave right away.
Paid leave.
Yep. Which raises some questions about how inclusive they really are if they're silencing dissenting voices. I mean, isn't the point of diversity to encourage open discussion?
Yeah, you would think. Yeah. So what happened to him after the paid leave?
Well, he describes it as this unpersoning experience.
Unpersoning?
Yeah, like colleagues wouldn't even make eye contact with him, wouldn't share an elevator.
That's intense.
Oh, and they moved his office.
Where to? Siberia?
Pretty much. They stuck him in a practically isolated office in the Russian department of all places.
Wow, the irony is thick there.
Yeah.
He moved to the Russian department for criticizing safe spaces.
Yeah, definitely makes you think. And it seems like this whole ordeal made him really re-examine some of the ideologies he used to believe in.
Like what?
Well, he talks a lot about postmodernism. He sees it as this slippery slope where everyone's individual truth reigns supreme, and that leads to undermining the very idea of an objective truth.
Okay, so unpack that a little. What does he mean by everyone having their own individual truth?
He's basically saying that postmodernism emphasizes everyone's positionality, meaning their unique experiences shape their perspective. So there's no shared reality, just individual interpretations.
So it's like we're all looking at the same picture, but seeing something totally different.
Exactly. And if that's the case, how can we even have a productive discussion, let alone solve problems together, if everyone is operating from their own subjective truth? It makes finding common ground pretty impossible.
Yeah, you'd never agree on even basic facts. You couldn't make decisions as a society.
Right. Rechtenwald says that this emphasis on subjective experience leads to fragmentation and makes it basically impossible to make objective statements about anything.
It's kind of like postmodernism rejects any overarching narrative, any meta-narrative, but then becomes a meta-narrative itself.
Yeah, exactly. It's a bit of a paradox.
Mm.
And it definitely leaves us with a lot to think about when it comes to navigating a world where everyone claims their own truth.
So a world where everyone's right, even when they're contradicting each other.
Yeah, something like that. But, you know, Rechtenwald's journey doesn't stop there. He also talks about moving away from Marxism.
Interesting. Why?
Well, he really grappled with the historical realities of communist regimes. Like, he brings up the Black Book of Communism.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of that. Pretty grim stuff.
It is. It documents all those atrocities and the millions of deaths under communist rule. Like, think Lenin, Stalin.
Not exactly sunshine and rainbow.
Yeah, not at all. And he's critical of those who kind of gloss over those historical facts. You know, some Marxist academics who try to sanitize history by leaving out those less savory bits.
So he's saying there's a darker side to the ideology they're promoting.
Yeah, he's basically saying, hey, let's not forget about the millions who died under these regimes. But is he saying all Marxist thought is flawed? Maybe not entirely. Like, there's this economist, Hans Hermann Hoppe.
Okay, I've heard of him.
So he draws on some Marxist ideas, but he argues that it's not necessarily the capitalist class that's the exploiter, but rather the state itself.
So he's saying it's about power, not just who owns the means of production.
Right, exactly. It's not about private ownership. It's about state power being the root of the problem.
So maybe there's more nuance to the whole Marxist thing than it seems at first glance.
Definitely. And that's something we have to keep in mind with all these interviews. There are always multiple perspectives to consider. Our job is to kind of unpack them all for you and hopefully, you know, get you thinking.
Yeah, give people some food for thought. Okay, well, speaking of challenging established ideas, our next subject, Jordan Peterson, really takes on a hot-button issue.
Compelled speech, right?
Exactly, especially when it comes to gender pronouns. It all started with his opposition to that Canadian legislation, Bill C-16.
Which he saw as potentially criminalizing the use of the wrong pronouns. Like, if you didn't use someone's preferred pronouns, you could face legal consequences.
Yeah, that's a pretty slippery slope.
And that's Peterson's whole point. He sees this as a step toward authoritarianism. Like, you're violating freedom of expression. You're telling people what they can and cannot say, even if they disagree with the underlying ideology.
So he's basically saying, I might not agree with you, but I'll defend your right to say it.
Exactly. And it goes beyond just the legal stuff. He also argues that this whole idea of multiple gender identities isn't actually supported by science.
Really?
Yeah. He points to research that shows the personality differences between men and women.
Oh, that's got to be controversial.
It is, especially in academia, where the idea of gender as a social construct is pretty dominant. But Peterson says those differences have a strong biological basis.
So nature versus nurture.
In a way, yeah. And he points out the irony of people who are pro-science on other issues, but then readily dismiss biological science when it comes to gender.
Yeah, that's kind of a head scratcher.
It is. And he brings up some fascinating research about Scandinavian countries. Like, they've really tried to create these gender-neutral societies.
I've heard that.
But, ironically, it's actually led to increased personality differences between men and women.
Whoa, really?
Yeah.
So instead of everyone becoming more similar, they've become more different.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. It really makes you question whether there are these unintended consequences to trying to engineer society in a certain way.
Like, are we messing with something we don't fully understand?
Maybe so. But this is all just one part of Peterson's work. I mean, he's also really big on self-authorship and personal development.
Right. I've heard of his programs.
Past authoring, present authoring, and future authoring. They encourage people to take control of their own lives and aim for personal growth.
So taking ownership of your past, understanding your present, and shaping your future, it sounds very empowering.
And it's grounded in psychological research. Plus, they've shown some really impressive results, like improved university student performance.
Wow. Especially, I've heard, for male students and non-Western ethnic minorities.
Exactly. And the thing is, these programs, they focus on self-reflection, setting goals, and taking concrete steps towards those goals.
It's all about recognizing you have the power to shape your own life.
And that really aligns with the whole Think and Act Locally thing. It's about empowering individuals to create change, you know, in their own lives, their communities.
Which, in a way, ties back to those safe spaces and trigger warnings. Because, like, shielding people from discomfort or challenging ideas,
you're potentially preventing them from developing that resilience and strength they need to really thrive.
It's like we're coming full circle.
Yeah, it's all connected. But we've only just scratched the surface of this Think and Act Locally world. There are so many more voices and perspectives to explore.
And each one pushing us to, you know, really think for ourselves, challenge our own assumptions, and maybe even discover some new truths along the way.
Exactly. And who knows, maybe even inspire some action.
So it's all about taking action, even in small ways.
Yeah. And speaking of taking action, maybe a little differently, our next deep dive takes us to April Kelly Woisner. A political scientist.
Okay, what's she all about?
Well, she's got some interesting research that kind of challenges that whole idea of millennials being the tolerant generation.
Really? But everyone says millennials the most open-minded generation.
Yeah, it's not quite that simple. She makes this distinction between, like, accepting diverse lifestyles, which millennials are generally good at, and then tolerating different viewpoints.
So being okay with people living differently is one thing, but actually respecting their right to have different beliefs.
Exactly. And Kelly Woisner says that true political tolerance, it's about being willing to extend basic rights, like free speech, even to those we really disagree with, like even our political enemies.
So even if you think someone is completely wrong, they still have the right to say their piece.
Right. It's about recognizing that even people we find offensive have that right. Which is where her research gets really interesting, because she's found that millennials, while they're accepting of diverse lifestyles, they actually score lower on political tolerance than older generations.
Whoa, really? That's surprising. I mean, everyone always talks about millennials being the most tolerant. So what's going on there?
Well, she thinks part of it is how the left, which, you know, a lot of millennials lean towards, how they view free speech. She brings up this concept of intolerance of intolerance.
Okay, break that down for me.
It's this idea that to promote tolerance, you have to be intolerant of intolerant views. So you end up silencing people deemed intolerant as a way to create a more tolerant society. It's kind of a paradox.
Yeah, it's like fighting fire with fire. It doesn't really work. But who decides what's intolerant in the first place? And couldn't that be used to shut down anyone with an unpopular opinion?
Exactly. That's the big question. Kelly Wassner points out the danger there. Like, are we really promoting tolerance if we're silencing dissent? It creates this atmosphere of fear, right?
Totally. Like self-censorship. You're afraid to speak your mind because you might be labeled intolerant.
And that's not really conducive to open dialogue, which is, you know, kind of essential for a healthy society.
So where do we go from there? How do we balance the desire for, you know, social justice and equality with the protection of free speech, even for ideas we find offensive?
That's the million-dollar question, right?
Yeah.
It's a tough one, and it ties back into that individual responsibility thing we were talking about earlier.
Okay, how so?
Well, if we want to live in a tolerant society, we each have to be willing to engage with different perspectives, even the ones that challenge our beliefs. And that takes courage.
It's not always easy to hear opinions that make us uncomfortable. But you know what? Maybe that's where the real growth happens.
Absolutely. Okay, ready for our next interview. This time, we're diving into feminism with Christina Hoff Summers. She calls herself a factual feminist.
Interesting. So what's a factual feminist? Is that different from a regular feminist?
Well, she's definitely got a unique perspective. She's critical of what she sees as the excesses and inaccuracies in modern feminism. Like, she's concerned about how a lot of women's studies departments are pretty ideologically driven.
So they're pushing a certain narrative.
She thinks so, and that they often present this distorted view of what women actually face in society.
So she's not against feminism itself, but she's calling for a more, I don't know, maybe a more balanced approach, more grounded in reality.
Exactly. She really challenges a lot of those commonly held assumptions. Like, for example, she tackles the whole gender pay gap issue.
Oh, yeah, that's always a hot topic.
For sure. So she's not saying there's no wage gap at all, but she argues that that often cited statistic, the one that just compares average earnings between men and women, it's misleading.
Why? What's wrong with that statistic?
Well, it doesn't take into account the choices women make. Like their education, their career paths, how much they work.
So it's not all about discrimination. There are other factors at play.
Exactly. She says a lot of the gap can be explained by those choices. And there's research to back that up, like studies that show when you adjust for things like hours worked, years of experience, types of jobs, the gap gets a lot smaller.
Okay, that makes sense. So it's more nuanced than just saying women are paid less for the same work.
Right. It's about recognizing the complexity of the issue. And there's actually a pretty interesting real-world example of this. Economist Mark Perry looked at the gender pay gap within the Obama White House.
No kidding.
Yeah. And guess what? They had a gap too, very similar to that adjusted gap we were just talking about.
Even in the Obama White House.
Yep. And get this, they attributed it to the same factor Summers talks about, different job roles, work-life balance choices. So even in an administration that was pushing for pay equity, that gap was still there.
Wow, that's pretty telling.
It is. And it suggests that, you know, individual choices and societal structures both play a role in shaping these outcomes. It's not just about pointing fingers at discrimination.
This is really making me think about the gender pay gap in a new light. It's more complicated than I realized.
And that's the beauty of these conversations, right? They push us to look beyond the surface and really grapple with the nuances. But, you know, the pay gap isn't the only thing Summers takes on. She's also critical of what she calls fainting couch feminism.
Fainting couch feminism.
Yeah.
Okay, I gotta hear more about this.
Basically, she sees this trend of oversensitivity and victimhood, especially among young women, like on college campuses.
So she's saying they're too easily offended, too fragile.
In a way, yeah. She argues that it actually promotes fragility instead of strength and resilience, which kind of undermines the whole idea of female empowerment, right?
Interesting. And it kind of circles back to those safe spaces and trigger warnings, doesn't it?
Exactly. Like, are we really doing young people, especially women, any favors by shielding them from discomfort? Or are we preventing them from developing the skills they need to deal with the real world?
That's a good question. It's like, we started with Michael Rechtenwald criticizing safe spaces, and now we have Christina Hoff Summers saying something similar about this culture of oversensitivity.
Yeah, and it all ties into that question of how to balance the desire for a just and equitable society with the need to foster individual strength and resilience.
It's a tricky balance.
Hmm.
But it seems like a really important conversation to be having.
Yeah, it's a balancing act for sure. Okay, who's next on our list of Think and Act locally interviewees?
This one might surprise you. It's Anthony Esselin, a literature professor. And he's got some interesting thoughts about diversity. Diversity,
yeah.
As in like ethnic diversity and all that.
Right. But he argues that this modern obsession with like quantifying diversity, it kind of misses the point, especially in education. He's talking about the context of a classical liberal arts education.
Okay, so he's not against diversity.
But he's questioning how we define it. Like, he says true cultural diversity, you find it in studying the great works of the past, no matter who wrote them.
So instead of just reading, like, contemporary authors from various backgrounds,
he's saying dive into those classic works, like, you know, a Spanish epic poem from the 16th century. Don't limit yourself to just modern voices.
Expand your horizons, right?
Exactly. Esselin thinks that kind of deep engagement with different cultures over time, it's way more enriching than just checking off boxes on a diversity checklist.
So it's about the quality of the engagement, not just the quantity of representation. But didn't he get into some hot water for saying this?
Yeah, he did. He was at Providence College, a Catholic school, and he wrote some articles criticizing their approach to diversity. Well, you can imagine it didn't go over well.
People called him all sorts of names, I bet.
Oh, yeah. Racist, sexist, the whole nine yards.
It's kind of ironic, isn't it? Someone arguing for a deeper understanding of diversity being labeled as intolerant.
Yeah, it is. And it highlights that tension we keep coming back to. How do we promote open discussion and intellectual exploration when people are so quick to shut down certain viewpoints?
It's like they're afraid of ideas that challenge their own.
Maybe so. But, you know, true intellectual growth, it requires us to be open to those challenges, to step outside our comfort zones and grapple with things that make us uncomfortable.
It's about humility, right? Admitting we don't have all the answers and being willing to learn from others, even if we disagree with them.
Absolutely. And these interviews, they're all about that. Encouraging intellectual curiosity, questioning, exploring, always learning.
It's like they're saying, don't just accept what you're told. Think for yourself.
Yeah, and that's a pretty powerful message, don't you think? It's about taking ownership of your beliefs, your actions, your life.
And, you know, after diving deep into all these Think and Act Locally interviews, I'm kind of struck by this mix of, I don't know, caution and optimism.
How so?
Well, caution, because it's clear that challenging the status quo, even when you're just trying to get at the truth, it can come at a price. But also optimism. Because it's inspiring to see people standing up for what they believe in, engaging in these tough debates, and encouraging all of us to really think critically about the world.
And that's what we've tried to do here today, right? We didn't just want to summarize these interviews. We wanted to get you thinking, to challenge you, maybe even make you a little uncomfortable.
Because that's where the real growth happens, when we engage with different perspectives, even those that make us squirm a little.
Exactly. So what resonated with you? What made you think? What questions are you still wrestling with? Those are the things to hold on to, the things that can spark further exploration and, who knows, maybe even inspire you to take action in your own life.
Because ultimately, that's what it's all about. Think and act locally. Start with yourself, your community, and see where it takes you.